It's punk rock bowling time. That's right, for the 24th year, one of the greatest festivals on earth, in my opinion, returns to downtown Las Vegas the weekend of May 25th, 26th, and 27th. I have had some of my greatest times playing this thing and just hanging out at this thing. You want to know how much this festival speaks to Turnout of Punk's mindset? The headliners are Devo, Descendants, and Madness. Every day of this festival, the lineup is stacked with amazing bands of all types and stripes of punk and hardcore from all different eras, from ska to post-hardcore. We're talking like Bratmobile to Rock from the Crypt to Stiff Little Fingers to the Cosmic Psychos to Scowl to Chad. And then there's also all these late night after shows which are happening, and you wouldn't believe the lineup of these things, from the Zeros to Agnostic Front, and everything in between. This festival is out of control for fans of punk. So I hope I will see you there, because this isn't like some sort of festival that you just go to and the bands are secluded in some sort of backstage area. Bands and fans and just punks alike are all just taking over downtown Las Vegas. So you turn around and all of a sudden you're gambling beside John Doe from X. I don't know if John Doe gambles, but if you turn around on the buffet line, you'll probably see me. And you better believe we're going to be talking about punk music. And because this festival loves this podcast as much as this podcast loves this festival, Punk Rock Bowling is bringing you a series of special episodes. So each and every week, I will have an episode going up featuring someone that's playing this festival. And hot damn, are there some good ones coming. Head over to punkrockbowling.com and hopefully I see you in downtown Las Vegas, May 25th, 26th, and 20. Hello and welcome to another edition of Turned Out of Punk. I'm your host, Damien Abraham, and once again, I'm bringing you a conversation with someone who grew up listening to punk, may or may not still be involved with punk, but had their life changed by the genre in a major way. And today on the show, major influence on me. You may know him from Sonic Youth. You may know him from currently playing with Butch Tetris. You may even know him from The Crucifix. Steve Shelley is the guest on the show today, and boy, this is a good one. But first, if you want to get in touch with me, head over to the email address, turnedoutpunkpodcast@gmail.com. That is run by my brother and show producer and guest booker extraordinaire, and he will get the message to me. You can also find me on Twitter or Instagram at Left4Damien. There is a Facebook page, an Instagram page, a YouTube page, and a TikTok page, all for this podcast right here. Those can be found at Turned Out of Punk on those respective platforms. If you want to support the show, tell all your friends about it. Let them all know that you enjoy this podcast that is done twice a week here over on the feed these days. You can also check out the band I play in. We are called Fucked Up. You can find out more information at fuckedup.cc. We have just released a newish record's finally up on all sorts of streaming places called Cops. And then we have also put up a brand new single, Born Annoying. That's annoying that I can't remember. But you can find out more over at fuckedup.cc or at fuckedup on Twitter or Instagram and check out those records. I'm pretty stoked about both of them. They're raging. Don't worry, it's not a poppy fucked up. It's tear your face off fucked up. That's my kind of fucked up. Anyway, on to today's show. Today on the show, as I said off the top, a legend, Steve Shelley. And I tell this to Steve, there's this part in, I believe it's Schizophrenia, which is the opening part of 1991, The Year Punk Broke, an incredible documentary by filmmaker Dave Markey about Nirvana. Well, Sonic Youth mainly, but Nirvana opening for them and Dinosaur Jr.'s in it and Gumball, Ramones. It's what got me into punk, but there's this opening number of Schizophrenia that's unbelievable. And there's a shot of Steve Shelley playing drums with Maraca. And I remember seeing that as a early entry point into punk rock, and that blew my mind. I know he didn't invent that, but that was the first time I had seen it. And oh my gosh, he is one of my favorite drummers ever. And someone that, obviously, Sonic Youth being a huge, hugely important band, and his involvement in Sonic Youth being hugely important and influential, but also because of the Crucifux, a band that comes up on this podcast all the time. We go into it extensively on this episode. I should add another place that goes into it extensively is Sam McPheeters, the great Sam McPheeters, former guest of the show, punk rock hardcore legend. In his book Mutations, he has a great chapter about the Crucifux and Doc Dart that I strongly recommend reading. I blank on the title of the book in this episode, but there you have it. I also blank on the name of the embassy, mistakenly calling it Call the Office, which is another historic venue in London, Ontario. But the venue we're trying to think of is the embassy when that comes up later on. I think that's it for notes on this episode. Head over to wharfcatrecords.com and .com and check out Bush Tetris Records. The incredible They Live in My Head LP from last year is fantastic. You can also pick up a Rhythm and Paranoia, the best of Butch Tetris as well, which is a great entry point to this band that is hugely important and weirdly overlooked. They will be playing shows this summer with Steve. Unfortunately, not playing shows anytime soon that I can report about hearing or anything is Sonic Youth. But you can pick up and relive an incredible era for this band. This band's like my Grateful Dead. There's just certain live eras that you can kind of go back and revisit with Sonic Youth. And just always an incredible live band. So most recently, they have reissued the legendary Sonic Youth bootleg. Feels weird talking about a bootleg like that. Walls Have Ears, which was a double LP. I believe, three shows back in 85. Sonic Youth has now lovingly reissued this thing, and you can pick that up over at, where's the best place to grab that these days? Just Google it. Anyway, I'll have a link in the bio, or the description, not the bio, the description for the show. All right, it's late. I'm not going to ramble on anymore. Here's Steve Shelley. Unturned Out a Punk. Steve, thank you so much for coming on the show.
You're welcome. Nice to see you.
Yeah, it's been a while. And I've, you know, obviously over the years, I've met you in person a few times. We've played some shows together, but I've never been able to punish you like you're going to get punished right now. So
really?
All right. Oh my God, dude. There's so much I've wanted to talk to you about.
I have no idea where you're going with this.
Don't worry. It's all nerdy. It might test the memory banks, but we'll find out. I got to start them off the way they all start off, though, which is, how'd you get into punk? Do you remember the first time you ever came across it?
You know, I'm from the Midwest. I'm from Michigan. And I was like a teen when punk was happening. And I was really into the Beatles. That was my thing in the mid 70s. And I just started hearing about this music that was weird and dangerous, and seeing Johnny Rotten and Sid Vicious on the cover of Rolling Stone. That was big, but a little bit, I think one of the things that clinched me, though, is more of a post-punk thing, is starting to see some of those bands on Saturday Night Live was a big thing for me as a young teenager. So catching Devo and especially Talking Heads, who played Artists Only and Take Me to the River, which is a phenomenal cover that's better than the original, which is hard to do. And so anyways, it was Midwest things, like the media, God bless the media. And And you know, and hearing about the Pistols and post-punk.
Did you like, you know, because also there's, you know, you bring up those SNL performances, and there's kind of like, it's amazing what an on-ramp they were for people, you know, like this kind of see this stuff on TV. And I also like that B-52's performance
Sure.
as well. And they're all three of those are just like all time. I guess there's also the Elvis Costello one that's up there
Yes,
too.
exactly. Yeah. And then, you know, and the stuff that would appear on Fridays a little bit after Saturday Night Live, you got to see the Jam and of course the Clash you know, and everyone.
How much awareness was there just kind of being a young kid about like Detroit rock and roll, like, you know, like the proto-punk stuff that would have been happening a few years earlier?
Yeah, that was all. I didn't learn about that until I moved to New York.
Yeah.
early Michigan rock. You know, we knew about the Stooges, you know, but to tell you the truth, it's like when I grew up, it was Seeger and REO. You know,
Yeah.
that's what was going on. And so when, you know, Talking Heads or Elvis or anyone appeared on one of these shows, it was like something that you had to have, you know.
Well, it's funny because like I don't think, yeah, the Stooges records don't get reissued till the late 80s, right? Like it's
No, we knew for my little gang, we knew about The Idiot and Lust for Life, and that was our gateway to the Stooges because David Bowie produced, you know, this Michigan vocalist, you know. Oh, he's also in a band called the Stooges. So yeah, it took a while to learn about that. And the MC5, you know, definitely. But the, yeah, a lot of it I didn't really dig into until I joined Sonic Youth.
Where did you kind of go from seeing this stuff on Saturday Night Live in terms of like, was there any sort of local bands happening around the time? Because there's like such a incredible deluge of punk from Michigan.
Not where I'm from. I was from a small town, about 2.5 hours north of Detroit, and Detroit was not easy access for me until after I graduated from high school and owned my own car. Because you just couldn't get anywhere in Michigan without a car. I didn't get to check out things in Detroit until the early 80s.
When did you start like playing music though? 'Cause like you have that band, the No Zones, really early on, right?
Yep. That was almost my embarrassing first band, but not quite. Embarrassingly named first band, but
What was the very first band?
the first one was called Deja Vu.
That's awesome. That's like deja voodoo, right? Like that's
Right.
classic up here. So
It's like 12-year-olds like to name in a band.
so was that punk, that stuff, or like new or like post-punk kind of vibes, or
No, it was like a garage band. It was made up of that was kids just learning to, you know, the three chords and bashing it out on the drums. We played Alice Cooper, Seeger, probably some Beatles in there because we were all Beatles nuts, and trying to it cover band. The first one was a cover band.
what about No Zones? What was the kind of vibe of that band?
That was New Wave, and it started playing some originals.
So was it like how did No Zones play shows? Like were you able to kind of play with
Yeah,
other
we would
bands?
play not with other bands, but we would like rent the library you know, performance hall and oh, you can get the library auditorium for $60. And so we would rent that and, you know, charge $1 to get in or something and hope that you could make your money back. But we were too young to drink, too young to be in bars. So, you know, we were like a garage band that, you know, played lawns, you know, lawn parties and shit.
A DIY punk band putting on
Yes.
your own shows.
Well, in our own way, yeah.
Yeah. Well, that's the thing, the best thing about punk was that it was sort of permission to be amateurish with what you're
Yeah.
doing.
Yeah, and to play music before you could drink, you know.
Yeah.
It's like drinking was such a like it was so intertwined with rock and roll, you know. You know, the whole ridiculous party and are you fucked up and all that, you know. All that was so intertwined. And so when you were 13 or 14 and you didn't care about alcohol, you know, punk and post-punk were a really good avenue to investigate.
So what was the vibe of Faith and Morals? Because that's the band you after, I believe, right?
Mm. Yeah, that's a little bit later. That was a band riffing on Joy Division and New Order.
But by this point, are you kind of playing outside of your town? Are you getting out a little bit more?
Yeah, Faith and Morals was a East Lansing band. I would drive from Midland to East Lansing and practice or play a show. And those were becoming more like club shows. We would play sort of empty warehouses in Lansing, but then we would go to Detroit and we would play like a gay bar or a gay disco at the time. That's where, you know, where we were welcome to play at that point in time.
So what's the scene like at that point? Like, did you, cause like eventually you wind up in a band with Steve Miller from The Fix. Like, did you play with The Fix or ever see The Fix?
Oh yeah. Yeah.
Oh, that's awesome.
Yeah. I think The Fix were maybe one of the first local punk bands I saw in Lansing. Yeah. Yeah, definitely. At a place called Rick's Cafe.
Legendary. That's incredible. So did you have a copy of Vengeance?
I don't, but that was probably one of the first do-it-yourself singles that I ever saw back in the day. That and the Necro 7-inch would have been, you know, that they actually had those at shows and like, oh, wow, you can make a record, you know, just slowly getting enlightened with all this.
Well, that's what I love about the Detroit stuff that's happening, because obviously the Detroit hardcore thing has become really celebrated with like Necros and I guess lumping The Fix in there and Negative Approach. But there's also like L7 and Blight and, you know, like yourself with Strange Fruits. Like there's a sort of real arty bend to all of it too that's happening. Like other, like sort of an artier edge to the scene as well.
Yeah, it's funny that the hardcore of Michigan has resonated for so long. Because to me, L7 really represented that era the best, you know. Mm-hmm. To me, they were Detroit independent rock in the early 80s.
They seem like the band that kind of like straddled both scenes. Like they could play with the hardcore bands and then they were also like really arty and could open for big new wave band.
Right, right. They would be the band that in 1982 or 83, if Iggy was coming through and playing the Royal Oak Music Theater, L7 would be the band to open, or U2 or whoever was coming through in the early 80s.
So would Strange Fruits ever play like the Freezer, or like was it sort of like a different venue circuit?
Yeah, I'm not sure if we ever did play the Freezer. We might have. We've definitely played with all of those folks, but maybe not at the Freezer. I know the Crucifix played at the Freezer. Not sure about Strange Fruit, and also same band, Spastic Rhythm Tarts. It might have been Spastic Rhythm Tarts might have played there.
Is that like in, were you like aware of like Nihilistic Spasm Band by that point, or is it like
not at all? No, never.
So what was sort of the influence on like the artier stuff? Because like Strange Fruit is like, it's fascinating when you go back and listen to it, because it is, it's like really dense and really experimental that early on. And so different from The Fix, obviously.
Yeah, yeah. And it was so surprising when Steve asked to play with us. He actually asked, hey, could I jam with you guys? And one of our guitar players had just moved to Chicago. So that's when Steve came in. And it was a weird mix. But the band actually existed longer without Steve than with Steve Miller. And it was kind of inspired, not kind of, it was inspired by the pop group and New Age Steppers and the Slits and, you know, Brit post-punk. And then the Birthday Party also started creeping in there.
So where are you hearing these records from? Like, was there a record store in particular that kind of was like bringing all this stuff in on import, or is it like, is there a college station or anything?
Yeah. The first indie music I ever heard on a college station was on WCMU. I think that's their call letters in Mount Pleasant. Hmm. And the place that we would go and buy independent records or imports would be Flat Black and Circular in East Lansing. And I think that place is still going.
I think it's like a legendary spot too.
Yeah, yeah. Definitely bought one or two Joy Division 12 inches there.
Yeah, it's been amazing how, you know, kind of dependent you were on having that cool store or having that cool College Station just to hear stuff. Like, because it was, information was such a commodity at that point.
Sure, sure. It was really different.
Yeah.
It was really different.
Were there a lot of sort of like a tape scene and tape trading scene in terms of that stuff? Because like it seems like, yeah, a lot of bands are putting out vinyl really early.
Well, tape, compilation tapes amongst friends who had no money. So you would get a comp tape and it would have, you know, the Minutemen from Sickles and Hammers or something, you know, but like just things that you never saw or had a chance to grab. And I definitely, you know, heard early DNA because of compilation tapes. And so that was really, really a loved ritual back then.
Yeah. And it definitely kind of has a, like there's like this sort of physical remnant of it too, yeah, where like there's, you know, like these tapes never went away. So like years later, you can stumble on a tape that someone made you, mm-hmm, and there's still that kind of immediacy to it.
Yeah.
Were you like aware of all, you mentioned DNA, like, so were you aware of like the No Wave stuff that would have been happening in New York around that time?
Just some of it, because, you know, we couldn't afford to grab everything. So you grab the few singles or records that you could grab, and then you would have to rely on your friends for these mixtapes. But yeah, I was aware of the No Wave and you know, in little bits and pieces, you know, whatever would flow to the Midwest.
So it must have been kind of exciting, I guess, when you arrive in New York years later and all of a sudden you're in this scene. Or were you kind of like already in this scene because of the Crucifix? Like, would the Crucifix cross over with those worlds at all?
Well, no, we went there and played, but it was, moving there was a totally different thing than being there, you know, playing CBs with the Crucifix. I mean, being there every day, yeah, it's fascinating. It's a fascinating place, and it still is, you know.
Well, I guess by that point too, like a lot of those people had moved on to sort of the cinema transgression sort of stuff, or, you know, like it felt like that was the continuation,
mm-hmm,
of it.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. Some people were, you know, working for TV or for film, or, you know, so yeah, that a lot of that had moved on.
So how did the Crucifix come together?
I think Doc Dart saw the No Zones play in Lansing once or twice, and he hit up the bass player and I, if we wanted to do something at some point. And so I think he and his friend Terry drove up to Michigan or drove up to Midland one weekend and played with Scott and I in Scott's mom's basement. And I think that's how we started getting together. And then the next time Scott and I would drive down to Lansing and practice in Doc's basement, and Terry had disappeared. And now Doc's younger cousin, Joe Dart, who was still in high school, was playing guitar.
So I guess there's overlap between Strange Fruit and Crucifix.
There was. Both bands existed at the same time. Both bands were sort of part-time bands because, you know, people were in school or had real jobs or whatever. So, you know, I would kind of flip-flop from one group to the other. Whoever was more active, I would show up and do whatever I could.
It seems like Crucifix, there's a lot of wreckage in the wake of the shows and just sort of the legend of the band. And it must be weird to also then be in this other group having to deal with sort of the one band. Like, is it a different culture around the bands at that time, or did they kind of exist together?
No, they existed together. 'Cause even when you played on a hardcore show, you know, everybody had, you know, they still had records by the Pop Group and the Gang of Four. So, you know, it was still, people were open-minded, I mean, for that sort of thing.
Yeah, it hadn't divided as much as it does later on.
I think, like Strange Fruit was still playing hardcore shows. And Crucifix never really fit in either. We were sort of an odd cousin to the whole thing.
Well, it's funny because it kind of invents an archetype of a band, the Crucifix, that exists in hardcore to this day. And I think, you
What's
know, like
that?
a band that doesn't really fit in with a lead singer that is confrontational. And that's kind of like, you know, I'd be lying if I said fucked up didn't exist in this sort of archetype away, especially in the beginning. And it really is. There's tons, like, you know, like Hoax, The Feeders a few years later from Phoenix. There's like this, you know, and I think G.G. Allin would be sort of the worst version of this thing because it's kind of different. But like this becomes a thing that always exists in hardcore to this day.
It's funny, I would never have connected G.G. Allin to the Crucifix, but it's funny that you say
Well, I'm not the first, actually. It's funny because
that.
in Tony Rettman's book, there's actually a quote from Matt O'Brien, and he talks about how Doc Dart was the proto G.G. Allin.
I don't believe that. But it's possible,
It's obviously a lot more cerebral. Like it's. I wanted to get your take on G.G. Allin because when you show up in New York, Gigi's there. Thurston winds up doing that show with him and Jay. You know, I think
No,
you'll you
Thurston
know
didn't play that
shows. Yeah,
show.
you know show the show in the end. That's right. Jay winds up playing, and Cosley, you know, obviously does the band with him and stuff. But I imagine you would have had a real. I was going to ask you, what was your take on Gigi having, as according to Matt O'Brien, been in the proto Gigi band in a way, but a lot more cerebral. Like I don't mean to be kind of, you know, and completely different, like not as scatological and ultimately abusive as G.G. Allin.
It's a stretch for me it's a stretch just to relate Doc to that. It was, I think it was, it was a homage to the Stooges, to Iggy, more so than anything else. I think when I got to New York, I think Gigi was something that we joked about, but we didn't take very seriously, and although the fright factor was was definitely serious, but I don't think I really, really was that interested in Gigi until like I was on tour years later and someone played me like a, one of his country albums, and I was just dumbfounded, that he did that too.
Well, it's interesting how geography plays into music so much. Like, you know, when Gigi gets to New York, eventually kind of winds up in that performance art scene a little bit, right? Like there's that compilation with Annie Sprinkle and him and a bunch of people doing like talking performance art, and he kind of gets, you know, there's that actually in the last Gigi show when he's wandering around the Lower East Side, there's a great moment where this art couple comes up to them and hands him his daughter, like, "Hey, Gigi, great to see you. Like, what's going on? What are you doing here?" And he's covered in blood and shit. And like with the Crucifix, I think if you guys had been in New York, it would be interesting to think about where you would have fit in and where what it would have been, because it is a lot more cerebral than a lot of bands that you would have been playing with at that time, kind of on the hardcore circuit.
Yeah, I don't think we could have played the hardcore gigs at that time to many more times because we played a hardcore matinee one of the first times in New York, and Doc is just giving the New York punks just the hardest time. He's so he's terrible with the audience. It's easily they could churn on him.
It must have been like weird on those tours, like showing up into a place like DC or showing up into Boston or New York, like places which have kind of hard scenes, especially the hardcore scene where there's like people that react. Like I find Detroit, like, you know, obviously this is just for me as a fascinated person who spends a lot of time thinking about I wasn't there, but I find what the thing I love most about that kind of Michigan Detroit scene is that it is so open to music and so open to different forms of expression within underground culture, whereas some places have a little more restrictive views on performance and how you should perform as a musician at around that time. And mm-hmm. so it must have been weird rolling into some of these cities as this band.
Yeah, I don't know. It was weird rolling in anywhere when you had never been on tour before. You know, our first tour was in a school bus, you know, rented by yippies in New York City for this Rock Against Reagan tour. So, you know, we're traveling with a bus full of hippies and, you know, 1982 or 83, whenever that was. So it's all bizarre.
Yeah. It's funny too, because you bring up the yippies, they're the sort of internal kind of presence in the early punk scene, from DOA's management and Subhuman's management to stuff that's going on in New York. Like, the yippies seem to be sort of this true proto-punk ideological scene in a way.
They certainly supported it, or in whatever the way they could, I guess.
Well, because Madam's Organ in DC, where the Bad Brains used to go, was like a yippie space, wasn't it, or something? Or like they had some yippie connection too, even in DC.
That's before my time, so I don't know about that one.
It's just so interesting how it's like, yeah, like in every different scene, it's sort of like involved in some sort of way. It's some sort of like the hangover from the 60s.
Well, they were responsible for getting us out of Michigan. You know, I think we'd hardly been out of state. You know, maybe we made it to Ohio and Wisconsin and Chicago. Yeah.
So how did the name of the band start to spread? Is it through Touch and Go, or is it through Alternative Tentacles? Because it must have been before the Alternative Tentacles thing.
Yeah. I would say Maximum Rock and Roll. You know, we had a demo cassette that we sold there. And I think that's how a lot of people found out about the band.
Did you guys get out to the West Coast ever with the Crucifix?
Yeah, we did. Opening for the Dead Kennedys. I forget which year, if it's 83 or 84. But it's a West Coast tour. Kind of maybe from San Francisco up to Seattle. And a lot of Oregon.
Oh, yeah, absolutely. Because I know, because this tour comes up a lot on this podcast. And it's something else I wanted to ask you about, because, you know, years later with Sonic Youth, you wind up meeting and interacting with, I'm sure, a lot of the people that you interacted and met with during the Crucifix, you know, like.
Yeah, just like 2 years before. Yeah.
Yeah, exactly. Like, or even like later, like Toby talks about that show and how terrifying Doc Dart was. And he grabbed her at one point and it freaked her out and stuff. And then so you're meeting these people later on. Was it ever awkward, or was it always like sort of this interesting, were people always excited because of the connection? Or
it was usually funny. I remember pulling into to sound check on a Sonic Youth Nirvana show in the Northwest somewhere, maybe in Oregon again, and Kurt was on stage checking his guitar, and he was playing, I don't know if he saw me or what, but he was playing the little guitar riff from By the Door, the really annoying song from our album. And no one else in the world would know that stupid guitar line, but I just had to, you know, look at him and smile. But that's usually how, you know, people would acknowledge it with a wink, you know.
Are you aware of how there's been like this massive resurgence in popularity for the Crucifix in the last sort of like 2 or 3 years?
No.
Oh, sorry. My kids are becoming to be dropping off music gear. Sorry about that.
That's all right.
Just on the podcast, bud. Oh, sorry. No problem. Keep it down. Okay, buddy. Love you. So they're super Nirvana now. So they want to start a band. It's
good.
Very exciting to see happen. It's a very interesting thing, because they have no interest in what I do at all.
Oh, funny.
Nirvana's the gateway. But
funny.
Yeah, but in sort of the last 3 or 4 years, there's been this wild resurgence in popularity or an interest in the band, to the point that there's also like a Doc Dart secret society thing where people get Doc Dart propaganda packages in the mail randomly, and no one knows where they're coming from these days. Like, obviously not anything connected with the band, just fans, but it's,
yeah,
because it's always been a band that like is right there in terms of importance to this thing. Huh. Like, Butthole Surfers and Crucifix, I think, are the ids for hardcore in a lot of ways.
Well, that's funny because, you know, I don't look back and wish things had been different too often. But I wonder, like, why didn't the Crucifix become more like the Butthole Surfers, you know, sort of more like just sort of let our freak flag fly. But I don't know. It was the time and the place, I guess, that affected a lot of that. But I didn't know any of this about the Crucifix, though. I mean, to me, the record isn't even in print. So, you know, and I don't know why. People have told me it's because Doc asked them to keep it out of print. But
it's weird that, you know. But we live in a time where that doesn't even matter, right? Like, we live in this era where now the legend just can kind of build on its own. And I think it takes time, right? Like, I think I always point to Jandek as being the ultimate sign that it takes time for everyone to kind of find their fan base and stuff. And I think Crucifix, the whole way through, there was always a cult around that band. Like, it was never like an obscure band to me. Like, it's always been in the conversation. That's why it's been interesting to watch it go from this thing that was always in the conversation to being this thing that people are now kind of fixated on and talk about a lot. Like, it's really, Sam McPheeters writes a lot about the Crucifix in his new book, or his book that came out a couple of years ago now. And
what's that called?
I'm trying to remember what it's called. I'll figure a way to send it to you. So I can,
sure.
Yeah,
sure.
I'm blanking on the name right now, and I feel bad about it. I'll fix this in the intro, so I'll let people know where to get it. And he was on the show before, and we talked about the Crucifix on that episode as well.
Oh, funny. Yeah.
You need those bands that scare people and kind of push things. You need that in all art, I guess, right? So you know where the limits are. And I think their Crucifix are the Midwest version of that band. I feel like it would have been very different, though, than the scene you kind of wind up in. Or is it kind of the same thing? Did Sonic Youth ever play with the Crucifix early on?
No.
How did you first meet them? Because they were they came through Laughing Hyenas, I know, later on, right?
That was all my connection. I mean, knowing Larissa and John back from the Michigan days. Thurston found out about the Crucifix because of Maximum Rock and Roll. He bought that cassette, and he and Lee came to the Sunday Hardcore Matinee at CB's, and I met them there. At the time, we had been talking about possibly Lee recording the next Crucifix record.
Oh, wow.
At Wharton's.
So is that the one that Corey kind of started that never got finished or never came out?
No, that's the first material. That's Corey basically recorded. I think that's the demo tape, basically. I think that's Corey's Touch and Go recording, which just never, none of it ever came out other than that cassette. And one song came out in the Touch and Go reissue that came out.
Okay. Yeah.
Touch and Go magazine reissue.
Yeah.
There's one song in there, I'm sorry, I'm spinning around, but Thurston and Lee came to see the show.
That's the whole point behind the show. Ramble, please.
And I met them there and was talking to Lee about recording. That's how I started a relationship with the guys. We were going to come to New York and record, but the band imploded and the bass player, Mark Hauser, and I wound up moving to New York instead of recording there.
Welcome to Prime Video's Culture-Rated Collection. This is the place where Black is the main character, where we don't jump through hoops just to hear our voice and can fall in love with illuminating documentaries like Giannis, The Marvelous Journey.
I'm just a hard worker that's trying to survive.
Enjoy the animated series, The Second Best Hospital in the Galaxy.
All doctors report immediately.
Where where we dive into something new like the latest season of Them, The Scare, and the award-winning American Fiction.
Welcome home, baby!
Or add to the experience by buying or renting the biopic of a legend, Bob Marley, One Love.
I want my music to unify people.
And add on channels like Paramount Plus and Stars to bask in nostalgia with Beverly Hills Cop.
This is the cleanest police car I've ever been in my life.
And BMF.
You're about to take over the whole nation.
Explore Prime Video's culture-rated collection and enjoy old school greats and new school hits. Prime Video, find your happy place. Restrictions apply. See Amazon.com/AmazonPrime for details.
Did you do any bands in New York before? Because Sonic Youth comes back from that European tour famously, and Bob leaves the band, and that's when you join the band. But were you doing other bands before that?
In New York?
Yeah.
No, I was going to auditions.
Okay.
It was really funny. I would go to auditions that I would find in the back of the, you know, the adverts in the back of the, in the classifieds of the Village Voice. And I would go to these auditions, and like one was like, everything was like the Smiths, you know, yeah. About the band. And then I went to another one where I live in New Jersey now for years and years, but I had to go to New Jersey and get on a bus and then met this black clad rocker and played with this band who were like a Bauhaus band. And so every band was like someone who had already happened, and and so I was going to these auditions, and I was like, fuck, I want to just, you know, join a band like Sonic Youth, but not like Sonic Youth, you know.
Yeah, yeah.
But you know its own thing, but
So were there ever any bands that you tried out for where you're like, oh, this could work, or is it just like all these sort of like freak show things?
No.
When you joined Sonic,
none.
were you taking in shows at that time too in New York?
Yeah, like,
were you...
yeah. The first show that my buddies and I got to see was somewhere in like a warehouse in Midtown. We found this flyer, and basically, it was Live Skull, Rat-It-Rat-R, Honeymoon Killers. It was like basically everybody we wanted to see in New York, except for Sonic Youth, you know, because they were in Europe. And so we just like happened on the, you know, we were just like sitting down in the front of, you know, watching these New York bands play, and just like, this, you know, this is where we want to be, you know. And I don't know if you know much about Rat-It-Rat-R, but they were incredible, and they really stood out amongst you know, that bill, you know.
I only know obviously the records, but weirdly there's also, I believe, Mike from the Sadies did some project with some people from Rat-It-Rat-R, because I remember being, our kids go to school or went to school together, and I remember him and I having a really deep conversation about the band one morning before our kids went in.
And especially a great drummer who I think did just pass away maybe before COVID, but a fantastic drummer who was the first great New York City drummer that I saw when I moved here.
Oh, that's awesome. It's such a cool scene that's happening in New York. Well, rest in peace, obviously, but it is definitely a cool scene that's happening in New York around that time. Is it after the poorly dubbed Pigfuck scene, kind of like that next wave of bands, or is that still kind of, is the media still trying to make that a thing?
I think that's right about the point when I moved there. Like that show that I went to, I think the media would have called that a classic pig fucker show, you know.
Yeah, pig fucker.
I don't know if that came from Chris Gow or what, but yeah, I guess I moved to town in the middle of that.
And so when you get asked to join Sonic Youth, that must have been amazing, because now you wound up in a band exactly like Sonic Youth.
Yeah, that kind of like.
What was the first Sonic Youth tour you did?
It was in August of 85. We were mostly playing Bad Moon Rising material, because that album had just come out a few months ago. Mm-hmm. So it was booked by Gerard Cosley, and and head out into the Midwest. And so I saw all my old friends with, you know, to them, it was like, Steve's coming to town. He's got Steve's new band, you know, which was not the case at all, you know? But yeah, so we crossed United States in summer of 85.
And so is that the tour with Laughing Hyenas? Are they on part of that thing, or do they play with you guys on that tour?
I think that's a little too early for them. I think they joined us more like 88. I think they were a little bit later. Okay. Around the time of Daydream Nation, they would have come in.
It's interesting, like that era of touring, because it's sort of the pre everything exploding and changing, I imagine, but it's the post kind of hardcore era. And there's, I guess, like it's yourselves and Husker Du and the Replacements and Dinosaur Jr. around then too. But like, it's really sort of like the foundation of what would become like alternative music or college rock for a little bit referred to.
Sure. And I think, you know, Black Flag and SST made that possible by those tours that they did, you know, in the early 80s, that it, you know, they created that network. And actually the next tour that we did was probably booked by Greg Dukowski, you know, not Gerard, who that wasn't his forte, you know, he was doing a friend a favor, you know, but so next we were with Global probably soon after that.
Yeah, it does. It's that network that comes up time and time again, like DOA and Black Flag kind of setting this sort of, roadmap in place that people still use it to this day.
Definitely. I think it changed American music.
Yeah, it's fascinating interviewing people from like the pre-hardcore era of punk versus the post kind of Black Flag, DOA kind of era, about how they would tour versus where it just makes no sense. You would go to like a city and spend like a week there, or you'd you know, like just do all this stuff or like ping pong around the continent basically.
Yeah.
And then post these guys coming in kind of with their rigidness, establishing this network.
Yeah. And if you talk to Mike Watt, the Kano version.
Yeah.
Econo.
Yeah, exactly. Like it's it's one of those great things that I think punk that sort of transcends punk into every genre of music. Even like, I think it's, you know, probably in hip hop, this is a touring cycle that people use now, or a style of people touring, you know. What were the bands that you guys were kind of playing with in terms of like those West Coast shows and like, what was the scene like that you were kind of
in 85?
Yeah. In 85.
Yeah. Through the Midwest, it would be some touch and go bands, you know, De Kreutzen. I'm not sure if we played with Tar Babies or Mecht Mensch, but it would, when Madison, it would be one of those groups. And then, you know, if we got out to Seattle, it would be with
Green River.
I think with Green River. Yeah, I don't think they were. I think the first time I played there with Sonics, it was Green River, because Crucifix had just played with Green River too, like a year or so before. So, it would have been Green River, and then as we got down to Southern California, it would have been more SST type bands. I know that we played with the Minutemen once or twice. Early, it would have to be early before D passed. So we would play with Minutemen in 85 then.
Yeah, it rests in peace, obviously, once again.
Yeah, it's sad. He was a favorite, you know. I loved D, loved the Minutemen.
They are definitely one of those bands that, you know, the records have power, and you know, I pick up and listen to the records, but to see them live, and you pick this up from watching live bootlegs as well, but to see them live was just transcendent.
Yeah, I was lucky to see them two or three times and loved it.
When did you start feeling things changing? Because it's only a short period of time. Like, you guys were putting out classic records every year for the next few years, but when did you start seeing that, oh, this, something's happening?
It was a slow ramp every year, and every year you would do something that you didn't do the year before. So it wasn't like what happened to Nirvana, obviously. It was this real gradual thing. And so we sort of, you know, learned about the business. You got a little more sophisticated with how you dealt with business people, and it kind of went that way, you know, until we signed with Geffen. Then of course that was a, you know, a burst of money and energy around the band, but it was odd how natural the band's growth was. You know, like this year we went to Australia, New Zealand, and Japan for the first time, you know, and the, you know, 2 years later we went to, you know, the Soviet Union and, you know, just kept on doing, like, you know, then after that you would, you know, we went to Southeast Asia and played in different countries, you know. It was just things that you wouldn't, you know, that first tour, that band tour going to Columbus, Ohio from New York, you weren't thinking that soon you would, you know, that we're going to be in Jakarta, Indonesia. You know, it was a world away.
Did you get a vibe early on that this was global with hardcore? Cause that's one of the things I love about hardcore, and you see it with this metal as well. But I find with hardcore more so, there's like this sort of international network that establishes as well as a national network where, you know, there are bands in Japan, there are bands in Brazil, there's bands in Finland, and Maximum Rock and Roll is a great right. place for covering this. Like, were you aware of this sort of thing that was happening as well at the same time?
I think just mostly through Maximum Rock and Roll and just, you know, the network. You would learn about things from the network, you know, from going on tour and having, you know, opening for someone and, you know, learning what they had to tell you and someone else opening for you. And, you know, it was just, you know, lots of information being shared.
It's interesting talking to people around the world that are kind of in punk and alternative music or whatever, like, you know, punk, we'll call it punk, where Sonic Youth winds up being that band that comes to play Indonesia, or when we went to China, talking to kids that saw you guys in China.
Yeah.
Just like the kind of like the band that sort of brings this thing in the same way Black Flag and DOA were in America and in Canada earlier on, but internationally to places when you start touring, like, did you have, and I guess it's through the major label this kind of comes, but like, did you have any hangups about signing to the major label? Was that ever something?
Yeah. Oddly, I was the one member who was least into it because I was such a DIY punker at that point. Yeah. You know, I think I, at that time, I would have preferred to go to, you know, I think my dream label at the time was to be on Mute proper. Cause, all my heroes were there, you know, Nick Cave and Roland, you know, with these Immortal Souls and my friend Epic Soundtracks on drums. So I think I wanted to be on Mute.
Yeah. Rest in peace again.
Too many of them.
Yeah, absolutely. It's such a cool label as well. And like 4AD, I guess, would have also been a place you guys could have fit in on at that time, but everything is so much smaller at that
point.
Yeah,
maybe, but that was a little bit, it had a little bit more of their own style. And so I don't think Sonic Youth would have been able to have that imposed on them, you know?
Yeah.
4AD sort of had a look, and yeah, I don't think we would have fit.
It's funny because there's more of a universal or uniform look to their records and a uniform sound to their records with 4AD. But you're right, like, it does have a very similar, but I think that's the thing that like a lot of indie labels wind up doing, where the label in a way becomes not bigger than the band, but like puts itself out on that way.
Right. Yeah.
Did you run the Sonic Youth fanzine, Sonic Death?
No, but I was sort of the in-between.
I was a member.
Oh, wow.
Big fan.
Oh, wow. That's so funny.
I love that thing. Yeah. But also that was a, you know, in terms of getting a cool fanzine, there was definitely so much stuff that I still, because there was that reissue that came out of Art Metropole in Toronto of all the issues, like a compendium like years ago, I think early 2000s. And I picked it up when it came out, and I still go through, I'm still learning from.
Oh, funny. Yeah.
It was like so much deep cut stuff and just like every genre is covered.
You know, there was just so much going on in that time, and you were just so excited to, like, you know, spread the word. Like, have you heard this? You know, that was how things were.
What was it like going to Japan for the first time? Like, what bands did you play with?
Well, we played with the Boredoms.
Of course, yeah, that makes sense. Sorry, I should not.
Yeah, I think Pussy Galore actually had beat us to Japan, and they said, you got to play with this band. You know, they're insane. They're like a Japanese Butthole Surfers, you know, and they were, of course, fantastic, and they became very much their own thing and not a Japanese Butthole Surfers at all, very much the Boredoms, you know, through the years. So Japan was the greatest, you know. It was, you know, you felt like you were on a capitalist Disneyland it was truly a capitalist wonderland, you know, walking around there.
Every record store, everything you could want to buy.
Definitely. Well, the records, yes. But the big thing back then for us was coming home with these with these VHSs of American bootlegs, you know, like the Stooges and Alice Cooper and James Brown on Soul Train. You know, there would be these video stores that would sell, you know, illegal videos. And if they had your band in their collection, they would give you 10 free videos. So we would all walk out of there with bags of, you know, VHSs and stuff them into our suitcases to take home.
That's awesome. Were you aware of Gizm?
No, I don't know what that is.
Oh, Gizm, G-I-S-M, or Jism, ah. I guess. But they were like, Sakevi, the lead singer, is the guy who, I guess, attacked the audience with a flamethrower one time.
Oh, wow. Oh, yeah, yeah.
Threw a saw blade into the crowd. But they were, I'd be fascinated to talk to Sakevi and see if the Crucifix weren't weirdly an influence. But it's almost like you guys are starting at the same time. And his voice is kind of similar to Doc's in a lot of way. So it's just like amazing how there's these two confrontational bands on the other side of the world that, and also they sonically don't really fit in as a punk hardcore band too. Like they're doing all sorts of weird experimentation. Poison Idea covers them on a later record. And
what do you think Doc was influenced by vocally?
I don't know. I wanted to ask you because it is one of the most, I think that's the barrier of entry to that band. And I think we finally hit a point in music. We've hit the tipping point in music where people are just so open that I don't think Doc's voice is a stumbling block to people as much. But I remember the first time I heard it, I was like, why is he doing this? Like,
why? I think Howard Devoto.
Yeah. That makes sense.
Buzzcocks, yeah. And the Buzzcocks. Yeah. Public Image by Public Image, the specific song.
Yeah. Well, I wonder, like, did he try any other voices first, or did you hear, was that the voice he came in with?
No, I think that was it.
Because he's also,
because Similar Items and Hinckley Had a Vision would have been early tunes that we would have learned together. So yeah, he was already singing like that.
It's interesting because he's an older guy on the scene too, right? Like, because he's slightly older than you, I believe.
Yes, he was way older. He was, you know, we were just out of, you know, a year or two out of high school, and he was like 31. And he was married, and, you know, and he'd already been divorced. You know, he was 31 and divorced, and it was like, holy fuck, we're playing with this older guy.
It's definitely weird how that's something that happens in punk and hardcore where, and you know, not to say that this isn't abused, and I should acknowledge that, but at the same time, it is this weird Peter Pan Neverland situation where, yeah, like I had friends in their 60s when I was like a teenager because we traded records.
Yep.
And when you found someone that liked this kind of music, you're going to be like, oh, we're going to be friends no matter how old we are.
Yeah. So yeah, Doc was 31 and we were maybe, you know, 20 or, and so it was a big difference as far as life experiences, you know.
But he hadn't done any other bands before this either, right?
No. I think failed attempts, but yeah, I think he probably couldn't get along with anyone until punk rock came along.
Yeah. There's so many interesting personalities like that in another era, there's no way like Marky Smith would be making music.
Right.
You know, like it took
the folk scene of 72 or something.
Yeah. I guess, again, once again, unless you're in New York and you could be on ESP and be the Fugs and be
let your
flag fly.
Yeah. You know, not that you've asked this to be a Doc Appreciation Hour or anything.
No, I love this.
But one of the greatest things about being friends with this guy so many years ago, I haven't talked to him for decades, but was that he was such a record nerd, and it was not punk only. Like he in Michigan, there was this weird thing where, you know, in those pre-punk years, a lot of those people who would become fans of punk, they were listening to prog rock from the UK. And so Doc had all this prog, and you know, I wasn't as interested in that, but everything that came just before the punk explosion too. And of course the hippie movement too. He had all the good stuff, you know, and that's really what we bonded on was Neil Young and the Beatles. That's where Doc and I really, really connected.
It's amazing how Michigan has that kind of streak of people just being like deep music heads. Like, you know, mentioned the prog stuff, like Groundhogs and I guess Hawkwind as well. Like there is sort of that.
Yeah. But there was a certain guy, and it was a guy, he was a man. There was a certain guy who would have a really good stereo and would be able to buy those records. And it seemed like, and he was always older, you know, and our thing was a little bit more juvenile, you know? So, but there was always someone who like knew about those, like those weird ass King Crimson records that, you know, that we didn't know about, but, you know, pre the later stuff. And just, so it was weird that just that those guys often became punk aficionados.
Well, I get a sense from talking to people, especially people that were around an active pre-punk, that there's like this sense of waiting for this to happen. Like just these people being like, fuck, I'll cling to this, I'll cling to that. And then when punk finally happens, it's like, all right. And, you know, obviously their definitions are varied on what punk is, but this was like this thing that was building. And you see that with the Dr. Feelgood and some of the Detroit stuff we talked about, Michigan stuff and Radio Birdman even in Australia and the Saints and stuff. It really does feel like this was a culmination that just sort of crests. You bring up like the record collector thing in Michigan too. I find that like you talked to John Brannon, when he was on the show, he talked about playing Nirvana Lead Belly for the first time and stuff. Like it does feel like there's there's like a deep music head appreciation for all types of music, not just, you know, capital P punk rock.
Yeah, I guess being that we weren't really a metropolitan city area, if you weren't in Detroit, and Detroit was having its own issues at the end of the 70s and beginning of the 80s. Things got to us a little bit more slowly, you know, and so you know, you listen to Led Zeppelin and Neil Young remained relevant, you know, even when all this other stuff happened. You know, Thurston makes this joke about, you know, in the early 80s, everybody sold their Zeppelin records. And then a few years later, you know, after Sub Pop, they all went out and rebought your Zeppelin records. Well, if you came from Michigan, you never got rid of them. It's like, I still had, you know, Led Zeppelin 2 and 3 and whatever.
I guess meeting Neil Young later on, being such a fan, would have been a huge deal for yourself.
Mind blower.
Was it interesting that he was like a fan of the band? Like, because there's a certain point where the band becomes just a part of Americana. Like you're on the Simpsons, you're like, it transcends like any sort of alternative music to just become, you know, pop music. Not the musically, obviously, it's always fascinating and challenging, and I'm a fan the whole way through, but at the same time, it's like the world catches up to you a little bit.
I don't know. You just try and keep it interesting, you know, and keep, I'm not sure what to say about that.
Yeah. It's kind of a heavy question. I mean, to kind of hit you with that one.
No, I'm just not sure, you know, I'm not sure how to answer. Sorry.
No, it's fine. 'Cause I think you know, it's the band that gets me into music, you know, and it's actually you playing drums on Schizophrenia in the year 1991, Punk Broke with a Maraca, where I'm like, what the fuck is this? And like the one of the footage that they kind of cut to, that was just like a huge eye opener for me.
Mm-hmm.
So it's, you know, I Sonic Youth, the band that I spent a lot of time thinking about, you know, huh. And the Crucifix too. Like, that's what I was saying. I got a lot to punish you about on this episode. Was there any show, just to wrap up, that kind of sticks out in your memory in terms of the Crucifix that was like, well, this might have gone too far tonight?
I don't know. There were some shows where we definitely hated each other. You know, there were some really negative shows. I guess it's not controversial to say, for all of Doc's positive points, there was a lot that was very difficult to deal with. I everybody knows, right?
That's fairly established. Yeah, okay. like that's why I bring it up, because like in American Hardcore, not American Hardcore, sorry, in Tony Rettman's book, Why Be Something That You're Not, there's a very brief chapter about the Crucifix, and most of the people interviewed in it, like yourself, you got a quote in the band where you don't even seem, you know, you seem like you're conflicted about the legacy a little bit in the quote. And certainly the other two quotes are from people that have not as great things to say about the band. Like, it feels like it would have been, and I think that's why I find it so fascinating, because it almost is like an art project more than it is a Clash style band.
That's funny that you say that, because, and I'm sorry, I'm going to take a left hand turn, but that's how we used to describe Negative Approach.
As an art project?
When we first saw them, we thought it was an art project.
That's amazing. I love them. To me, they're you know, like, John is my Frank Sinatra. Like, that's where I go for.
It was not a diss in any way, but it just, like, we thought it was artful the way that it was so extreme. How extreme it was made us think that it was an art project.
It's funny too, coming from the Crucifix too, who are pretty extreme in their own right. I guess everyone's got a different definition of extreme.
Yeah. I don't know. We're from the land of the Stooges. I don't know what to say.
And I guess that's the thing that kind of permeates the whole thing the way through. I find it, although, fascinating when you talk to John, sorry to go on, but like, how much he rejects that first wave of Detroit punk stuff. He's like, no, that shit was just rock music. It sucked.
Yeah. Well, you know, and also, although not as big of a deal to John, but to a lot of us, that was the bar scene. That was like going to a stadium rock gig. You know, it was just so hard to get there, you know? So we didn't see those bands, even though we kind of existed at the same time. We had to go to the underage shows, you know.
Well, because there's so many, like Cold Cock, like I love those bands too. And it's funny because, like, I bring them to John, and John's like, oh shit, that's just rock, bar rock bullshit.
And John knows that shit better than I do, but to us, that was the stuff that was in the way. You know, it was like, it was from 5 years ago. And if you're not, you know, L7 or you know, whatever, we're not interested.
What about the Flesh Columns from Windsor? Like, they kind of would have been towards the tail end, I guess, of the Crucifix, right?
Yeah. I might have seen their name on a flyer. I didn't know much from Windsor, only that the radio was better and that maybe there was a show over there that we could play, which we never got to, but we always knew the radio was great in Windsor.
That's awesome.
But we did go to L7 and the Crucifix went to London, Ontario together.
Oh, wow. Where did you play with, like, the Hippies or NRG or?
No, we went to do, God, I wish I had a little bit more info on this for you, because you would know about it. But we went to do a 2-day residency in London, Ontario. This would have been 82 or 83. And we stayed above the bar, and it was like a flop house, like you know, men coming in and sleeping there at night with TB and stuff in these various rooms where we stayed.
Was it called, was it not called,
it was
the
a Western it's, name.
Yeah.
It was a cowboy name.
Indulge me for 1 second.
Yeah. You can, I'll wait. We went there for two nights, and the first night we got so much flack from the crowd, like kind of redneck flack. And at one point, someone like Larissa would wear these like sundresses, old, you know, vintage sundresses, and someone lifted up her dress, and like someone jumped and a fight started, you know, like protecting Larissa. And
wow.
And then we didn't get to play the next night. We didn't work well with the clientele, just the Crucifix and L7 and this kind of like a biker bar in London, Ontario.
I think it's called, I'm blanking because I think it was around for a long time with the hotel above it. And I think Dave Dichter wrote about it in Max Rock and Roll as being a place that he relapsed into smoking crack one time. And there's just
that
like
would be a place to do that.
Yeah.
It was a bizarre place. Yeah.
It definitely, I thought I pulled the record and it does not unfortunately have a picture of it on the cover, because there is like a weird little punk scene that I wonder if these were all kids that would have seen you guys play or something, because it does have a very kind of similar bend to L7. Like it's sort of darker punk, the hippies, NJF, and this band, the Generics, but they're all kind of like post-punky, gothy kind of punk bands that would have been 84, 85. They're putting out their records.
I'll see if I can find the name of it and I'll text it to you or something.
Yeah. I'd love to see that. That's awesome. That's wild.
Yeah, but that was a good one though. And spending time with L7, who we just worshiped. We thought they were the greatest thing. And, you know, and I don't know if you're curious, but, you know, as great as the Third Man record is, and I'm so happy to see that, it still didn't capture them. You know, there's still something that that I wish I could enlighten everyone to about how fantastic that band was, you know, and it came across, you know, live in these clubs, you know, and Lansing, Detroit, and Ann Arbor, and
yeah, like I love this, the you know, the old 7-inch, and obviously that reissue that came out, I think is fantastic. But they're one of those bands that only through talking to people that were there for it, like, you know, you get the scope of how important this band was. That like this is more than the Necros or more than Negative Approach or more than anyone. Like this is the band from that scene that would kind of carry
for that era. Yeah, for me, yeah, that's the one that spoke to me, and that's what I took with me when I left and, you know, and moved to New York, and I didn't know what was going to happen, you know.
Yeah.
So, but L7, that was my inspiration from Michigan.
What did you think of Touch and Go Fanzine and sort of Tesco V and that whole kind of Meat Men kind of world?
I think I was fascinated with it, and it was great that, you know, your band would actually get reviewed, you know, live, even a band that didn't have a record, you know, they would review, which was fantastic. And I think that sort of type of music press was a new thing to me. So a lot of it was not really my style. It did feel a little dark and negative for me at the time. A lot of the humor was not really my style of humor, but it was important to us, you know, and Tesco is a wonderful guy, and was, you know, there were a lot of sides to him, and he was a super intelligent person to get to know.
It's amazing how when you think about like that forced exposure of Gerard doing Conflict, like there was sort of this real dark humor, but very sort of similar aesthetic to most of that sort of big underground music press around then.
Mm-hmm.
They all kind of had that same sort of vibe.
Yeah. Yeah. I don't know where that came from. You know, it was sort of like, I don't know, like no one's watching. and like, so, you know, sometimes, you know, bad behavior would happen, or sort of, sarcastically using bad behavior, you know.
I think it's also
an irony or whatever.
Yeah, like testing limits too, and sort of obviously stuff that doesn't age and doesn't, you know, I don't think Gerard will ever, you said straight up, he'll never ever reissue Conflict fanzine. I don't think there's any chance of that ever happening.
Yeah.
But it was at the time, it was the, I don't know, like you're saying, like no one's watching, and you know, you're testing limits and sort of this, but it's interesting to see where that goes, because that ultimately leads to Vice, you know, like that sort of like approach to.
Yeah. Weird. Yeah.
Yeah. And which then ultimately leads to, you know, wherever that led. You know, there's this sort of, and it's interesting to follow these sorts of threads and sort of these like little ripples that wind up being huge reverberations.
Right, right.
Well, this has been a huge reverberation for me, Steve. And anytime you want to come back on this show, and please just feel free to give me all of the Crucifuck stories you have.
Oh, sure. I've forgotten most of them. But thank you. It was a really nice talk, and I really enjoyed speaking with you.
Thank you, Steve, for coming on the show. And anytime Steve wants to come back here, you're always welcome, buddy. That was a lot of fun. Once again, pick up All You Can by Steve Shelley that he's playing with, Bush Tetris or Sonic Youth, or if they ever do put out those Crucifux records again, grab some of those as well. Sam McPheeter's book, Mutations. Definitely read that. Lots of great Sonic Youth stuff. I could just go on forever talking about Sonic Youth things. There's a live bootleg, something Tiger. I can't remember right now off the top of my head. As I say, it's late. On that bootleg, they do a encore of all Ramones covers. Oh, it's a fantastic thing. I think I got it as part of the Sonic Death fan club. All right, that's it. Coming up on the next episode, well, we don't know because it's... So up in the air right now with these punk rock bowling episodes that are going to be going up. So I don't really know what's coming up, but there's going to be something awesome. And that's it for me. Remember, as always, Black Lives Matter. The lives and issues of Indigenous peoples all over the world matter. We need to protect trans kids and help trans people protect themselves and their rights. And stop hate and violence towards people of different faiths, different races, different nationalities, because... we are not talking about politics here. This is just basic human rights shit. Ceasefires are just basic human rights shit. People deserve to be able to live free from hate and violence and discrimination. So if there's organizations that are affecting positive change in your community and you want to get involved, get involved. I'm sure they could benefit from your time, or if you can afford it, some money or whatnot. Things that also get better when you get involved, punk. Anyone can do this shit. Start a band, start a fanzine, start a podcast, whatever. Start a band, start a fanzine. They're cooler. But anyone can do this shit. If I can do it, you can do it. So go there and do it. And it's never too late to start. Everything, you know, gets easier when you get older, maybe. I don't know about that. Gets way fucking harder. But go there and get involved. Speaking of getting involved, sign your organ donor cards. By the time they come looking for those organs, you don't need them. And I've seen the miracles happen that they can perform. So sign those cards. And then finally, try meditating. I know I'm not the first person to tell people this, but maybe it'll work for you. It worked for me. And once again, I am not any paragon of health and wellness. So if it works for me, it might work for you. Stick with it. There's lots of free places to try it. All right, that is it for me. Thank you for listening. See you on the next episode. Bye. It's punk rock bowling time. That's right, for the 24th year, one of the greatest festivals on earth, in my opinion, returns to downtown Las Vegas the weekend of May 25th, 26th, and 27th. I have had some of my greatest times playing this thing and just hanging out of this thing. You want to know how much this festival speaks to Turnout of Punk's mindset? The headliners are Devo, Descendants, and Madness. Every day of this festival, the lineup is stacked with amazing bands of all types and stripes of punk and hardcore from all different eras, from ska to post-hardcore. We're talking like Bratmobile to Rocking from the Crypt to Stiff Little Fingers to the Cosmic Psychos to Scowl to Chat. And then there's also all these late night after shows which are happening. And you wouldn't believe the lineup of these things, from the Zeros to Agnostic Front and everything in between. This festival is out of control for fans of punk. So I hope I will see you there, because this isn't like some sort of festival that you just go to and the bands are secluded in some sort of backstage area. Bands and fans and just punks alike are all just taking over downtown Las Vegas. So you turn around and all of a sudden you're gambling beside John Doe from X. I don't know if John Doe gambles, but if you turn around on the buffet line, you'll probably see me. And you better believe we're going to be talking about punk music. And because this festival loves this podcast as much as this podcast loves this festival, Punk Rock Bowling is bringing you a series of special episodes. So each and every week, I will have an episode going up featuring someone that's playing this festival. And hot damn, are there some good ones coming. Head over to punkrockbowling.com and hopefully I see you in downtown Las Vegas, May 25th, 26th, and 27th.